explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun, art, and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rackage have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now, they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in thousands.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abeloid rotifer worm. previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia. A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas. Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Eromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Stefan Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
After a year-long delay due to the pandemic, Euro 2020 finally kicks off in Rome, and football lovers all over the world are in a fever. Now, a French baker living in Germany has also seized the moment to create special pastries for the championships. Ludovic Gerboin is a huge football fan. He has made sweets for all the teams present in this year's Euros, but most of his cakes are inspired by the French and German flags. He has mixed bakery traditions from different countries to capture the multinational spirit of the tournament. Ludovic hopes his country of origin, France, will lift the much coveted cup, but he is also favoring Germany.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. Scientists and workers' rights advocates were among those who denounced the Biden administration's new workplace safety rules regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, which were unveiled months later than expected and which the Labor Department made enforceable only for healthcare settings, leaving grocery store employees, manufacturing workers, and others vulnerable to the continuing public health crisis critic said. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading Shameful Failure. Biden's OSHA excludes most workers from COVID protections. Stay tuned for more. Scientists and workers' rights advocates were among those who denounced the Biden administration's new workplace safety rules regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, which were unveiled a month later than expected and which the Labor Department made enforceable only for healthcare settings, leaving grocery store employees, manufacturing workers, and others vulnerable to the continuing public health crisis, critics said. At a recent hearing of the House Education and Labor Committee, U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh told lawmakers that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration OSHA final COVID-19 emergency temporary standard ETS will apply only to healthcare workplaces, requiring those employers to provide their workers with a safe and healthful workplace free from recognized hazards that are causing or likely to cause death or serious physical harm. Except for workplace settings covered by OSHA ETS and mask requirements for public transportation, most employers no longer need to take steps to protect their workers from COVID-19 exposure in any workplace or well-defined portions of a workplace where all employees are fully vaccinated, read OSHA new guidelines updated recently. Employers should still take steps to protect unvaccinated or otherwise at-risk workers in their workplaces or well-defined portions of workplaces, the guidance says. But, as HuffPost reported, this portion of the guidance is essentially voluntary. Walsh told members of Congress the Labor Department tailored a rule that reflects the reality on the ground. The success of all government vaccination efforts, plus the latest guidance from the CDC on the changing nature of the pandemic. Science tells us that healthcare workers, particularly those who have come into regular contact with people either suspected of having or being treated for COVID-19, are most at risk, said Walsh. Actually, science tells us highest risk is in food, agriculture, manufacturing facilities, and transportation logistics, tweeted Dr. Kirsten Bibbins Domingo, chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. A study done by researchers at a university earlier this year showed that American line cooks, warehouse employees, agriculture workers, bakers, and construction workers have the highest rates of mortality from COVID-19. In addition to excluding many vulnerable workers from the ETS, the Biden administration released the guidance weeks after it was expected in March. The Labor Department missed the crucial opportunity, said the National Council of Occupational Safety and Health, to protect workers that President Joe Biden had previously criticized former President Donald Trump for not safeguarding with an ETS. Jessica Martinez, the group's co-director, said this is a new insult on top of the injuries, illnesses, and deaths suffered by frontline workers and their families. vaccines have not reached all workers and COVID-19 is not over. Journalist Paul Blest denounced the new guidelines as horrible and embarrassing. Oxfam America said the long-overdue ETS represents a shameful failure of leadership by an administration that was elected on a platform of standing for the needs of all working people. We've learned over decades that employers, especially in low-wage industries, rarely choose to prioritize their workers' safety. We need government to mandate actions that safeguard lives and well-being, said Gina Cummings, vice president of Alliance's Advocacy and Policy for the Group, adding, to rely only on unenforceable guidance is almost certainly to condemn workers to face exposure to this potentially deadly virus. Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the lives of Rohingya people in Myanmar against the backdrop of the crippling pandemic as well as a military coup. And we shall take a look at the economic growth in Bangladesh and its prospective climb up the ladder of global trade and Asian geopolitics.
While Rohingya people are being relocated to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, prone to floods and cyclones, life is getting harder and harder for this Muslim minority community due to the deadly pandemic in their camps, as well as fires and violent Buddhist extremists rampaging their lives. Condemning the relocation, the United Nations and other rights groups have expressed concerns about the safety of the persecuted refugees, as well as their volition. Authorities say they only send those who have volunteered, but the Rohingya say they are being coerced.
Back in the time when the whole subcontinent was one entity under the British colonial rules, a lot of people used to move back and forth throughout the whole region without restrictions. But the World War II messed up the situation. The Rohingya were allied with the British and wanted their areas to be part of Bangladesh, then called East Pakistan. But Burma had an alliance with the Japanese invaders, hoping to topple the British rule. Thus were born the roots of the enmity. When the Burmese won the war and gained independence, they wanted to get rid of the Rohingyas since they saw them as illegal Bangladeshi immigrants in their country, or the remnants of its British colonial past. More than 130 distinct ethnic groups live in Myanmar, with the largest minorities having their own states under the Panglong Agreement in 1947. But the Rohingyas, even at over a million in population then, were not recognized, and they have been denied citizenship since the country's independence. To make it impossible for the Rohingyas to live there, Myanmar created a legal vicious circle. Under the country's citizenship law of 1982, only members of ethnic groups that settled within Myanmar prior to 1823 are eligible for automatic citizenship. And if they have descendants that enter the country before 1948, they can apply for naturalization if they can submit evidence and documentation. But most of the Rohingyas, who have been living in the area for centuries, don't have the proper paperwork because the country didn't allow them to.
The complex Rohingya refugee crisis aggravated in August 2017 following some small-scale attacks on remote police outposts in western Myanmar by armed groups allegedly belonging to the community. This was a pretext for the following systematic assaults against the Muslim minority, which human rights groups, including senior UN officials, have said amounted to ethnic cleansing. More than 700,000 Rohingyas escaped the genocide by Myanmar's military with little more than the clothes on their backs and joined 300,000 people already in camps in Bangladesh in 2017. Attempts at repatriation of the Rohingyas to Myanmar have failed because these stateless people, who have seen their villages burnt and wives raped by the Buddhist extremists and the military, were too fearful of further violence to return.
The COVID-19 pandemic has added to the miseries of the persecuted community. Due to lockdowns, most of these people have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity while hunger and poverty loom over the community. In recent weeks, dozens of Rohingyas, including children, developed COVID-like symptoms, but their camps lack testing facilities, and the community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. The spread of the virus is unavoidable in the camps because their makeshift shanties lean on each other and there is absolutely no support programs for food, sanitation or health care. As the virus keeps raging across the camps, they had to resort to home remedies and self-quarantine, but the destitute minority is getting closer to another humanitarian disaster if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Ali Johar, co-director of Rohingya Human Rights Initiative. First of all, I would like to thank Mr. Johar for being on the program and ask him to walk us through the crisis that has plagued the Rohingya Muslims for decades and why they are persecuted.
Thank you so much for having me here. Actually, this question is should be for the persecutors, not to the persecuted. But what I can explain to you is what actually has been happening with the Rohingyas since decades. So from the beginning, I may start from 1942 when around 200,000 Rohingyas had to flee the country in a first violent attack. And then in 1975, 15,000 Rohingya had to flee. In 1977, an operation called Operation Nagema, which is clearly a racial, attacks on the minorities. So this attack was, by the military to clear the what they call so-called foreign nationals. In 1978, another military operation led to 200,000 Rohingya Muslims flee from their homelands. In 1982, military amended the constitution that talks about three categorical citizenship, where one is for the indigenous people, other one is for the naturalized, another one is for the descendants of the mixed population. So in this indigenous category, Rohingyas had been excluded. Since then, no Rohingyas have been allowed to hold any public offices. In 1990, NLD won the general election, which was clearly ignored by the military. And in 1991, again, more than 200,000, around 250,000 Rohingyas had to flee because of they were used as forced labor. Our women had been used as sex slave by the military and raped, and because of the religious persecution as well. In between 2004 to 1997 to 2004. Around 230,000 refugees were repatriated under a deal by United Nations. But this kind of violent attack continuously took place since military started its dictatorship, which has ended up in a very most horrific experience of the Rohingya in their lifetime in 2016 and 17, leading more than 750,000 people fleeing to Bangladesh, joining exodus there. You know, it's been reported that almost 10,000 women have been raped, you know, thousands have been killed.
How has the situation changed since the coup d'etat in Myanmar, and is life any different for the Rohingyas who control the country?
You know, Rohingya have been facing decade-long persecution under the military rule. Whoever rules the country, the minorities have been, you know, at the end of receiving the violent crackdown. Since the coup took place, all the attention was on the, you know, rehabilitating the genocide survivors, that is Rohingyas. But after the coup took place, this entire world attention have been shifted to, towards human rights violation in the larger picture. So the process that have been initiated to rehabilitate the Rohingyas to actually go back to their homelands, and the Rohingyas who are hopeful to, you know, return to their homes very soon have become, you know, a delayed process. So as we were already in a confined situation, the coup has brought, you know, more worse situation for us, because it is the military which has been, you know, persecuting us, and it is again the military, same military government there now. So the coup has, you know, brought a devastation for Rohingyas. But there is a change in the, you know, general public minds, because the military has, you know, manipulated the situation of Rohingyas by misinforming the general public that it is because of the Rohingyas, you know, it is themselves they are creating the situation in Rakhine State. The military just playing with the rule of law. But now the general public is realizing that they have been misinformed, that, the general public has been, you know, used as a campaign against the Rohingyas. So now there is a shift in the understanding of the general public that we were actually misinformed. In fact, you know, we were used in the persecution of the Rohingya Muslims.
Thank you, Mr. Johar, for being on the program. And now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Remove the Fence has portrayed a grim but normal scene in the lives of kids from the minority community. RYMGMGSA has pointed out one of the particular problems of living in camps. Rain is no longer a blessing when you have no roof. Rohingya Girls Matter has touched upon yet another ugly truth about their ordeal, an hour-long line for a sip of water. Tahir Azam has talked about the situation of coronavirus spread across their refugee camp. Zia Nang tells the story of a Rohingya man who has been tortured by Myanmar's military. He is Rohingya refugee living in Bangladesh camps.
Good hand pollution and what a little give them this country people is the Rohingya coming to Bangladesh. Balukali camp 11, 15 because and family very, very dangerous, very, very serious from and family and no rights, no quality, no water. Now really, now money in give them very dangerous, very big problem. But they were cancelled.
listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since the COVID pandemic has hit the world, the economies of many countries have contracted significantly. But an Asian country, not known for its economic resilience, is doing surprisingly well. Emerging as a new rising star, Bangladesh even managed to leave India and Pakistan behind in terms of per capita income. Moreover, the country is now amongst those countries that helped India in the devastating new wave of the COVID pandemic.
As one of the emerging economies of South Asia, Bangladesh has seen significant economic growth during the past decades and is seemingly set to become the next economic superstar in Asia. With nearly 10% rise in per capita income for the year 2020 to 2021, Bangladesh has surpassed India and Pakistan with an estimated $2,227. As a result of higher than expected remittance flows, the World Bank has revised Bangladesh's GDP growth from an earlier prediction of 1.7% to 3.6%. When Bangladesh announced its independence from Pakistan in early 1970s, the newborn state was struggling with war, famine, and mass exodus. A large number of Bangladeshi people were killed on their way to Pakistan and India that were the richer and stronger countries back then. But now the landscape of the country seems far more prosperous than the rest of the countries in the subcontinent. Now it is Bangladesh that is helping others. Bangladesh has agreed to provide a currency swap of $200 million to Sri Lanka for a period of 3 months. Moreover, Bangladesh is also amongst the 40 states which provided assistance to India during the devastating second wave of the pandemic. The South Asian nation provided India with over 10,000 vials of remdesivir, as well as PPE kits, zinc, calcium, vitamin C, and other tablets. Once believed to be so destitute that illegal migrants from there kept overrunning the neighboring borders, Bangladesh is now way happier and richer than most of the countries of the subcontinent.
Back in the 70s, some believed that the new country seemed destined to fail. Henry Kissinger, then Secretary of State, famously called it a basket case. However, recent developments proved otherwise, as the growing importance of Bangladesh is not just limited to the context of South Asia, but the whole world. In addition to remittance flow, a large portion of Bangladesh's GDP is from the garment industry, with overcrowded factories and substandard conditions. If Bangladesh seeks to sustain its growth and become an economic powerhouse, it should recognize and address its vulnerabilities.
Upon creation, Bangladesh started its economic trail with implementation of socialist policies and nationalized the majority of its corporations. It was not the right way and decreased industrial production near to zero. Therefore, the government gradually revised the policies and returned state-owned enterprises to the private sector. The reforms raised the contribution of industrial sector to the GDP, thus accelerating the growth in industrial and service sectors. With a massive labor force that is among the top 10 across the globe, today Bangladesh is one of the largest garment manufacturers of the world. The sector accounts for over 84% of the country's total exports and provides employment to more than 4 million workers. In addition, the country's service sector is now the largest contributor to their GDP and employment. Another factor behind the growth is the remittance by the diaspora. In 2019, about 10 million Bangladeshi migrants sent home over $18 billion. This is nearly 7% of the total GDP of the nation and has created a steady flow of foreign currency to the country. To keep up the growth, Bangladesh faces numerous challenges too. The manufacturing is not properly diversified, and depending so much on one single industry can have its own caveats. Despite the growth, Bangladesh witnessed a 20% decrease in foreign direct investment last year, and over-dependence on remittance can adversely affect the domestic production.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Dr. Ahsan Mansoor, Executive Director of Policy Research Institute of Bangladesh and Chairman of BRAC Bank. Now, Mr. Ahsan, welcome to the show. During the COVID pandemic, the economies of many countries have contracted. How come Bangladesh's economy did not shrink?
Well, that's a very good question, because we think that economy expanded, it didn't shrink, but it slowed down quite a bit. We are growing at 7% plus rate, so it came down significantly because of COVID. Primarily, our several sectors was not much impacted. Agriculture was completely outside the COVID, so, and they had a very good output. So agriculture sector was completely intact and growing. Other than the urban centers, most of the rural area was untouched. For all practical purposes, there was not much of an impact there of the COVID. So urban centers were shut out, and so industries were impacted, but they recovered. The large industries recovered very fast. In fact, many of them did not, even the bank that I am chairing, we didn't have any big loss or anything. Our profitability was the same as before. So it shows that it's an indication that the economy was pretty robust in many ways. So I think agriculture plus large industries coming back very fast, the small ones have been impacted significantly. And some of the service sector activities were impacted initially, but then they rebounded very fast because construction and other small service sectors, including retail, that they recovered very fast. So overall, growth slowed down, but it was not negative.
How did Bangladesh manage to leave India and Pakistan behind in per capita income, and what are some of the factors behind this growth?
Okay, yeah. You see, Bangladesh has been growing very steadily in the last 30, 40 years. In the 80s, our growth rate was 3%. In the 90s, it was 4%. In the 2000, it was 5%. And then in 2000, it was 6%. And then it was 7%. And it touched 8%, but it didn't sustain because of COVID. So that's one part of it. Why it is growing steadily is in part because of, we do invest a respectable amount, about 30% of GDP is investment every year in the economy. That's a sizable amount. Plus, we have a real strong macroeconomic stability. We never had very large fluctuations in the exchange rates and so on, unlike Pakistan, India, and many other emerging countries, middle-income countries. So our exchange rate is very stable. And compared to India, our exchange rate in the last 2 decades probably appreciated by about 40%. 50%, our currency vis-a-vis India. And vis-a-vis Pakistan, our currency appreciated by more than 100%. So, and that exchange rate factor is plays a role in the dollar conversion to comparison purpose. So, Indian per capita income didn't grow as much because of the currency depreciation than Bangladesh, Bangladesh stability and so on. And we also have a stable inflation, about 5% or so. So everything taken together is a good environment, macro environment. Balance of payment has always been very strong, and our reserve position is very strong. We have, for our needs, we have $45 billion, which is our 10 months of import cover for us. And it's growing. So overall, the whole macro environment, and steady growth, and You see, in the IMF estimate, Bangladesh came out to be one of the safe two countries which is most stable in terms of economic growth and macro stability. So I don't know which one the other one. So that is, that speaks for itself. That's if you continue that policy for decades, it gives you result.
Thank you, Mr. Mansour, for your precious time. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Umar has hailed Bangladesh for its growing economy, noting that extending $1 million loan to Sri Lanka is a definite proof that Bangladesh is going up the global economic ladder. Srivatsa has drawn a chart to emphasize on some comparisons between India and Bangladesh. He underlines that Bangladesh is helping India in handling COVID, and then made fun of Modi's motto of progress, or Vikas in Sanskrit. Kanane Irrespon has used the news of Bangladesh's growth in per capita income as an opportunity to lambast the performance of Modi's government. Kanika Agarwal reiterates the fact that Bangladesh is now richer than Pakistan and India, and asks everyone to take a moment to digest this.
And that was our special episode on the looming humanitarian disaster awaiting the Rohingya Muslim community on the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Holding Trump and William Barr to account is not a matter of political payback. This is about the future of American Republic, says Tom Hartman, writer, in an article published under the heading, Donald Trump Must Be Prosecuted for His Crimes. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The crimes of Trump Americans should all concern themselves with are his crimes against their nation and democracy itself. Not only is there little evidence that anybody, including the Justice Department, is interested in pursuing these crimes, but Republicans in state after state are going out of their way to facilitate the future political criminal activity. America has always had a weird attitude about prosecuting the rich and powerful. Think about it. Outside of Jeffrey Epstein, can you name one billionaire or multi-hundred millionaire who has been seriously prosecuted for criminal activity? And Epstein, after initially being convicted some years ago, was treated in a hands-off fashion and allowed to continue his crimes with the support of some very consequential politicians and Florida prosecutors, at least until he was shut up for good. While there is a certain immunity available to very healthy people all over the world, both because they can afford the very best legal help and they have politicians in debt to them, other countries still manage to prosecute the rich and powerful citizens. Donald Trump brought criminals and fascists like Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn into the heart of the U.S. political system, and grifters and con artists like Betsy DeVos, Ellen Chao, and Wilbur Ross into the White House itself. And Trump also brought in the extraordinarily corrupt lawyer, Bill Barr, who had previously corrupted the office of Attorney General for George H.W. Bush, too. When Barr was Attorney General in December 1992, Bill Barr had struck. More recently, working for Trump this time, Barr oversaw spying on both reporters and Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee. But Trump was also committing crimes by himself, too. The Mueller report lays out 10 specific examples of Donald Trump committing the felony crime of obstruction of justice, and dozens of other examples of his criminality in the White House are well known. Whether it's taking bribes from foreign governments, passing top secret intelligence, or attempting to corrupt legitimate elections, there can be no doubt that Donald Trump was a criminal before he came into the White House and continued his criminal activity throughout the 4 years of his presidency. Rationale that tough on crime legislators have used for generations to justify harsh penalties is that if people are not held to account for their crimes, and if society doesn't see the example of people paying for their crimes, criminals will be emboldened and society will suffer under even greater levels of crime. Setting aside how that actually plays out in U.S. criminal justice system, there is a lot of truth to the idea that letting criminals get away with their crimes only emboldens them and those who seek to emulate them. The Boston Globe is now out with a series of articles about the crimes of Donald Trump and recently explicitly called for him to be prosecuted specifically for the crimes he committed while in the White House. Their justification for calling for the criminal prosecution of Donald Trump follows the same lines. If he gets away with it, what might another morally impaired future president, say someone like Ted Cruz or Rick Scott, be able to pull off using Trump's skating by as a president? Prosecuting Trump, Barr, and the other corrupt members of his administration and people around him is not a matter of political payback. It has very little to do with Donald Trump or the Republican Party. In fact, it's about the future of American Republic. They must be held accountable. President and Congress must appoint an independent special prosecutor or equivalent and set up an office within the Justice Department to look into crimes committed in the White House during the previous 4 years. If Americans fail to do this soon, it will become practically and politically impossible. And if America fails to hold its rich and powerful into account, particularly the man who corrupted the highest office in the land, Americans will have truly gone down the same path as an increasingly corrupted ancient Rome, leading straight to the death of the Republic, too.
Economic divide.
Hello, and welcome to Economic Divide. I'm your host, Kobe Tapley. Every baby that is born brings with it promises of advancement and development for where they are born, which in some ways contributes to the economy. But what if that population was on the decline in a very major way around the world? Well, that is the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines of this program: population stagnation, fertility bust, fact or myth? Have deaths started to exceed births? We will be checking out the numbers and see which countries are suffering from this, and of course, its economic impact. Then, the era of high fertility. Is it ending? But why? Is it because women have gained more access to education, perhaps, and contraception? Maybe migration to urban cities is the cause, or is the reason purely economical? In order to take a look at that, our next highlight is going to be case studies. We're going to be taking a look at countries. Which countries are suffering the most from declining populations? Is it China, which just allowed couples to have 3 children, or Italy, where maternity wards are shutting down, and Japan, was long been facing declining birth rates? And finally, one continent is going against the wave of low childbirth, and that is Africa. Countries there are outpacing the rest of the world, like in Niger, 7 children per woman, followed by Mali and Senegal. But believe it or not, these countries are on a downward trajectory.
The world population is always growing. The young and the old intersect paths. One group enters the workforce, the other retires. New ones enter this world, and the cycle continues. Most thought the world population had peaked, but there were warnings that it had entered a declining stage. Imagine entire regions where everyone is 70 or older. Imagine governments laying out huge bonuses for immigrants and mothers with lots of children. Imagine a gig economy filled with grandparents and Super Bowl ads promoting procreation.
There's a general viewpoint that a world with less people would be less burdensome on some key areas. Well, for starters, it is perceived that less people means more resources would be available. Climate change will not be as severe, and the impact on the environment would be less.
Just as significant as the increase in numbers is the fact that the global population is aging. Across the globe, the distribution of the population by age is shifting upward from younger to older ages.
But there's another side to the story when it comes to low fertility or fewer babies being born. It could actually have a detrimental effect on society. Fewer babies being born into this world would eventually translate into fewer workers. This would then mean that there would be more retirees. Just think about it. This could potentially turn societies upside down. The notion that a surplus of young people will drive economies and help pay for the old.
The majority, as I said, of the disaster displacement that we recorded is 98%.